solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Welcome to this new series of compilations of the Play to Potential podcast that we're calling Connecting the Dots. As you know, we recently crossed 100 guests at the podcast, and we are pressing the pause button on getting new guests, and we're using the opportunity to take stock and reflect on some of the learnings we've had at the podcast. For the next several weeks, each new podcast episode will be a compilation around a theme where I try and connect the dots between the various things we've learned at the podcast across the guests. We'll do this for a period of time, and then after a few months, needless to say, we'll get back to the long-term march towards adding to the library of guests at the podcast. We want to go through this phase of consolidation and taking stock before building further. To put it differently, we want to pause collecting the dots for a while and focus on connecting them. I sincerely hope you find these compilations of value. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I'm based in Mumbai, and my mission is to help growth-minded individuals play to their full potential. My primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a sounding board to leaders. However, I realize that my bandwidth is finite, and there are only so many people I can work with at a point in time. Hopefully, this content can make a difference to a wider set of people who are keen on playing to their full potential. To know more, you can visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. The first episode in this series was on internal self-awareness. This one's on external self-awareness. The two episodes do go hand in hand. Do try and tune into the other one as well, either before or after you listen to this conversation. I feel it will help complete the picture of self-awareness for you. The terms external and internal self-awareness come from Tasha Urick, author of the book Insight. She studied self-awareness for several years.
Self-awareness is made up of two types of self-knowledge. The first is something we named internal self-awareness, which is essentially knowing who we are on the inside. But equally important is something called external self-awareness. And in a nutshell, what that means is knowing how other people see us. And what was fascinating, at least to me in our research, was that we found that those two types of self-knowledge both are required for us to really be self-aware, but they're not related to each other, which I was kind of surprised by. I always thought, you know, if somebody kind of knows who they are from the inside, of course they would do the work and find out how they were seen on the outside and vice versa. But we discovered that they are, you sort of have to think about them as independent skill sets within the self-awareness area.
Before we move forward with discussing external self-awareness, here are the few themes we discussed in the first episode. We spoke about going beyond strengths and weaknesses and exploring other dimensions. We then discussed tuning into what is play for us in order to unearth our potential. We then looked at revisiting our formative years to see how we've been shaped by our early experiences and context. Then we moved to the how of building internal self-awareness. We first looked at three dimensions of mindful alertness, especially during high-stakes situations. We then discussed journaling, listening to our body, and practicing three levels of listening. Let's now turn our attention to the topic at hand. External self-awareness, which is how people see us. The first and foremost point I want to make around external self-awareness is that very often people see this as a once-a-year feedback exercise, often facilitated by the company HR. I find that to be a very narrow view and a lost opportunity. The more we treat it as our own personal responsibility to gather a regular drip feed of timely feedback than a once-in-a-while big bang corporate process, the greater the odds of us gathering valuable input that can help us evolve. The phrase that people often use to describe the process of receiving outside-in feedback in the corporate world is 360. And the question I often ask in these situations is, how 360 is your 360? If you look at your life and the number of people you interact with who have a helpful point of view on you as a human being, you will find that what is called as a 360 is often not more than a 90 or a 180 at best. The 360 in the corporate world is often a series of observations that your current set of colleagues have about you based on last year's behavior and performance. Now, are these the only people you interface with in your life? What about past colleagues? What about people in the ecosystem you interface with who may not be in your company? This could be customers, vendors, consultants, and so on who work with you. What about people on the personal front? Your spouse, siblings, parents, friends, and so on. Let me give you a concrete example. I've been working with a general partner of a venture capital fund as a sounding board. This is a journey that's coming up to 2 years. In this process, I've spoken to his co-founders in the current fund, his colleagues who report to him, his sister, his wife, and some of his batchmates and friends from business school, his colleagues in his earlier organizations to understand his hardwiring, entrepreneurs he's backed and where he's on the board, entrepreneurs the venture is backed and he's not on the board but engages occasionally. This is to understand how he adds value to the situation when another colleague is in the driver's seat, some of the investment bankers and lawyers he works with, and so on. Over the coming months, I might speak to his parents, his YPO forum members, and so on. You get the drift. The limited point I'm making is that the list in the 360 is often nowhere close to a 360. If we truly want to improve as a human being, we need to be open to gathering input from all the people we interface with and have touched in the past as well. I recognize that the time is finite and we may not be able to get to everybody, but therein lies the journey. Doing this exercise as a drip feed has unearthed all kinds of blind spots. More importantly, it has unearthed his superpowers, things that he can double down on going forward. We'll get to the superpowers in a minute. Let me also underscore an underappreciated point of external self-awareness. It's not just about going on a data-gathering expedition. It's also as much about creating a climate of psychological safety so that people speak their mind without inhibition. Amy Edmondson, professor at Harvard Business School, has studied this phenomenon extensively. She says that the people around us often run a calculus problem in their head when they're trying to trade off the risky payoff from speaking the truth versus the safer payoff from staying silent.
And so the calculus that I describe is something that's very simple, which is that if you're at work, there's an old saying, better to be, better to risk being thought a fool than to open your mouth and, you know, prove it beyond a reasonable doubt or something like that. It's a bad saying, but it's wrong, right? It's wrong in today's world. But the calculus is such that if you think about it this way, if I think your plan might be fatally flawed and I'm your subordinate, you're my boss. In that moment, I might be wrong, right? So in that moment, I can speak up and maybe save the day, but maybe not. Maybe you won't be mad at me, but maybe you will. And whether or not all of that will happen is going to be delayed for sure. I mean, your anger might not be delayed, but whether or not my intuition about the plan was right or wrong is going to be hard to sort of figure out objectively for a while. Whereas so I'm taking a risk, in other words. Whereas if I stay silent, there's no risk in that. If I stay silent, I'm just there. Nobody knows. You don't know. Nobody else knows that I had a thought in my mind. I had an objection and I didn't share it. So I talk about that is this fundamental asymmetry between voice and silence. The voice calculus will always lead subordinates towards silence, not voice. Therefore, as leaders, you have to override that natural instinct.
Very often, leaders say that they have an open door policy. In many situations, I notice that it's akin to a lion in the jungle saying, "I have an open cave policy. Anyone can walk in at any point." It's important to recognize that the climate we set in our various relationships has a direct bearing to the quality of outside-in data that we collect. Else we run the risk of misinterpreting silence. The next piece I want to talk about in gathering external feedback is around discovering our superpowers. In my work, I've realized that the returns from doubling down on the superpowers is much, much higher than just focusing on weaknesses. If I were to use the language of a venture capitalist, it's akin to really going all in with the one or two companies that are outliers than trying to fix other companies that are middling or not going anywhere. There are two perspectives I want to share here in terms of discovering our superpowers. The first is about how we pay attention to feedback. Whitney Johnson, who studied career reinvention while leveraging Clay Christensen's theory of disruptive innovation, speaks about paying attention to feedback that we often shrug off.
Distinctive strength. So what is a distinctive strength? A distinctive strength is something that you do well that people around you don't. Like the koala. So the koala, we look at the koala and they're like, oh, cuddly little animal. But the thing that we don't know is that the koala sleeps about 20 hours a day. So now you're like, okay, well, if I slept 20 hours a day, how would I survive? Well, the koala survives because it eats eucalyptus leaves, which are poisonous to humans and pretty much every other animal on the planet. So this now becomes its distinctive strength because it doesn't have to forage for food because the food's just when the koala wants the food's there. So what does that mean then for us is what we want to do is we want to play where no one else is playing. So the first accelerant of personal disruption, that idea of how to grow by playing and then play to our distinctive strengths. Now, the thing about strengths that is really interesting, there are a couple of things. First of all, we don't always know what our strengths are. And you're probably thinking, well, yes, we do. Well, no, we don't know what they are because we tend to be blind to them. They're blind spots for us because they're things that we do so readily, so reflexively that we don't see them. They're just a part of who we are. We're completely blind to them. Okay, so one of the things that you mentioned is this idea of what compliments do you shrug off? And so what we want to do with those compliments is frequently, if you or I get a compliment, we deflect it almost immediately. Like I have found over and over again when I'm presenting these ideas in a workshop or a keynote and I ask people what compliments, they can't tell me what they are. And it's the reason we do that is that we can't tell them is because as soon as we hear it, it's like it's Teflon. We completely shrug it off. We almost can't hear it. And then if we can hear it, because it's some people are complimenting us on something that's easy for us, we're like, well, but why don't they tell me something that I do well that I worked really hard to learn? And so one of the things that you want to do in order to know what your strengths are is when someone gives you a compliment, do that thing that you don't want to do and write it down because this is your genius. And if only when you know what your genius is, only when you know what makes you feel strong, do you know what your strengths are. And when you know what your strengths are, then you're willing to play where no one else is playing. And now you've got that second accelerant of personal disruption that allows you to grow. Now that you know where you want to grow, it allows you to know how to grow is you know what makes you feel strong and then you play where no one else is playing. So those are some starting points for you to figure out what your distinctive strengths are.
The other approach to discovering our superpowers comes from the world of sport. Dan Cable, a professor at London Business School and the author of the book Exceptional, speaks about putting together a highlights reel of our lives, a concept that we are familiar with in other domains such as sports.
I feel like I've learned a lot about how surprised people are when they get one of these highlights reels. And basically what that is, it is memories and stories from family, from friends, from colleagues, from mentors. It's people that have watched you over the years, even over the decades, and then they write a story that is their memory of a time you've done something exceptional. That's the name of the book. That's why that book is called Exceptional. There are times when you've had an extraordinary impact, and here's my memory of you doing that. And I just can't tell you, number one, how powerful and emotional that is to read it from other people as opposed to just self-reflecting. So that's one thing. I think a second thing I'd put out there is just the vast amount of new insights that you can get, because a lot of things that people remember for 15 years, 20 years, and they write down in a lot of detail, you might not even think of as a big deal. You know, you might think, oh, no, that's just easy. That's what anybody would do. And if you have 7, 8, 9 people writing different stories, but around that same theme, but you yourself just don't think that's a big deal, that highlight reel starts to unveil ways of you becoming exceptional. And I call them high leverage moves. It's just a way that you can do a little more in an area and create a much bigger impact, but you wouldn't do it because you kind of downplay it. You think anybody would do it.
As you can well imagine, this is a logistically cumbersome process. This involves reaching out to 20 to 50 people and crowdsourcing insights around when others saw you do something exceptional. If you need help in program managing this, reaching out to the various people, following up and even editing and putting it together in one coherent document, my team could help you. You can feel free to write to akash.deore@transitioninsight.com. That's akash.deore@transitioninsight.com. He could let you know the commercials behind something like this, and you could choose to proceed if it makes sense for you. This could be specifically relevant if you've hit a certain milestone, say 40 or 50, or if you've sold a company and you're looking for direction for the rest of your life. Gathering outside-in feedback can be especially relevant when we're going through a phase of transition. It gives us insights which can change the way we look at ourselves and fundamentally shape the landscape of opportunities that we go after. The key is to give it time. You cannot rush it. The other big challenge I notice is the sensitivity if you're a senior leader. You need to either find the set of people that can keep a secret or make an announcement that you're moving on and then embark on this exercise transparently. Rupa Kudwa, currently managing partner at Omidyar Network in India, speaks about her transition from Crisil to Omidyar. She refers to the fact that she spoke to 45 plus people to get a sense of what the possibilities could be before she zeroed in on Omidyar.
So I'd spent 22 years in Crisil, 7 years as the CEO. I just loved the job, and for years I said that it is the best job in the country, and I really believed it was the best job in the country. I think it gave you a ringside view of anything important that was happening in India, and it gave you a platform to shape where India was going in so many different ways, right? So it was phenomenal. So we had a ratings business, we had the global analytics business, we had a small and medium enterprises business, where we had evaluated 1 lakh enterprises, and we had a policy advisory business. So it was a very, very powerful portfolio. And I loved what I was doing. And I was very grateful to the company. I think the first emotion when I think about Crisil is really gratitude, because I think it made me who I am. It gave me the opportunity. And so I was very grateful for everything. I had turned 50. And I had already been the CEO for 7 years. I had another 10 years to go. And I said to myself that if I stay on for another 10 years, I would have ended up being the CEO for 17 years. And I don't think that's good. I don't think that's good for the company. It's not good for me. And I also figured that if at all I wanted to do something else, again, it was not clear what I wanted to do, this would be a good time because I would get a clear runway to do something completely different, not knowing what it would be. And so I had a chat with my board and said, I want to leave, but I'm not going to leave immediately. I will manage a smooth transition because I don't know what I'm going to do next. And to their credit, I think they saw the point of what I was saying. Of course, it took 9 months from the time I decided to the time I left. But because we were a public listed company, we actually disclosed as soon as I made the decision that it is my intent to leave at some point. And it took 9 months. And because it was public knowledge that I was going to leave, there was a friend who gave me some really good advice when I had decided to leave Crisil, but had no clue about what. And she said to me, go out and talk to people. And you will be surprised to hear how people perceive you. You may think you have an idea, but when you go out and start talking to people just to understand what is out there, you will be astonished and then you will have clarity. And I actually did that. Because there was so much time and I was, we were doing the succession and my, and because in Crisil, you know, I was just fortunate to have a set of clients who were all, either policymakers or regulators or CEOs of companies. And I had the platform to interact with them and everyone knew that I was going to leave. And so they all called up and said, let's chat, etc. And so I would go and have a cup of tea with. And I did this with about 45 people, I think, and over the 9 months. And it was just amazing, as my friend had told me, the insights that I got. And I think the first clarity that I got was on what I did not want to do. And I think that itself became clear to me through these conversations. And as people said, why don't you do this? Or we think, why don't you join us? And that gave me the clarity on what I did that helped in the elimination process in my mind. I don't want to do this. And then after that, I think it became much simpler. I knew there was a small subset of things that I wanted to look at. And that small subset of things was where can I use my skills and capabilities and apply them on a wider platform to achieve, to bring about some kind of change. I didn't know what kind of change it would be, right, in India. So I just knew that part of it, and I came through to that realization through these conversations and a process of elimination, and then it was serendipity, Omniji I called.
The beauty of these conversations is that they often open up a dimension that can sometimes create a completely new pathway. It's almost like 9 3/4 platform that features in Harry Potter. You walk through the pillar, and suddenly a very different world emerges. One such instance was narrated by Atul Kasbekar, a celebrated photographer, a name that's synonymous with the Kingfisher calendar. When I asked him about how he transitioned from photography to producing movies, he spoke about a moment of insight from a family friend who opened up a possibility for him, something that was in his blind spot.
I have a friend who's a spiritual guide. He lives in Bangalore, and he was saying that I think it's an excellent space for you because what you may not see is but what he sees. And it actually turned out to be quite true. He's saying, you're actually a very habitable platform for people who otherwise would never meet each other to be pulled onto and to coexist and work in a harmonious way and be able to create.
That's a great perspective.
Yeah. I never quite thought of that. Yeah. So I said, I'm a platform. Okay. So...
What made him say that, according to you? What do you think?
No, I was actually talking in terms of, should I stop doing photography? Should I do this? Should I do film production or not?
Yeah.
Seems like a dirty business. There are all kinds of, people who, for me, what you say is what you mean. If you didn't mean it, why did you say it? I hate to think that I have to spend my time thinking, he said this, but what did they mean? Where's the catch? Just look properly at clause 14.C.8, whatever, So.
Sure.
This is it. This was the deal. Which part did you miss? There isn't any skullduggery. It's just so tiresome to lie and play these silly games. If it's not, it doesn't work for you, it's fine. Like the other day, someone said no to a script we had, which is really okay. But they did the classic Bollywood thing of the idea of saying no because you might hurt them is to just avoid. So finally, I sat the person down. I said, listen, I'll tell you what. I'm made of sterner stuff. Okay. I'm very fond of you, and we can still be friends, and we may make a movie together, we may never make a movie together, it's still okay, we'll still be friends, it's okay. What will really piss the crap out of me is if you you know, decide to play these silly games and ignore and then duck and whatever. It's not that complicated.
Let's decouple the relationship and the transaction, right?
This doesn't work for me right now. Hmm. We'll find something else at some point, I hope.
Yep.
Wonderful. Rock and roll. How are the kids? No, bus. Hope yeah.
Correct.
So he said, no, you're good at this. You have to be the alkali who sort of neutralizes acidic situations. And, you just bring them and...
You're back to your chemical industry background, no?
and create an atmosphere where people can be harmonious. They work nicely as a machine unit and they do this.
It's just fascinating how little we know about ourselves and how much we can play to our potential if we just start tuning into the voices around us. If we listen carefully enough, moments of epiphany could come from anywhere. Anu Madgaonkar, a partner at the McKinsey Global Institute, speaks about a moment of epiphany in an interview process.
I go back actually to a moment of epiphany that I had in a very unexpected place, which was when I was being interviewed by one of the most senior partners in McKinsey 15 years ago or more, when I was applying to join the firm. And I had had a series of interviews which went fine. And then this very, very senior partner was sitting there and asked me a little bit about my career goals or something like that. And I started telling him about how I enjoy every aspect of my professional journey so far, except this one particular phase. And he stopped me dead in my tracks. And he just, in a very penetrating way, he said, "Why did you not enjoy that phase?" Mm. And sitting up in that interview, actually, I went through a moment of complete self-awareness. I was not aware of this, but because he asked me that pointed question, I took a couple of minutes to think about it. And then I came back and I said, as I think about everything, I discovered in that phase that I'm not fundamentally a very competitive person. Mm. I'm much more a collaborative person. Mm. And that situation demanded a level of competitive behavior that I was not very comfortable with, which I was not aware of earlier. So I think having that conversation with someone who provoked me to think was actually very helpful. Mm. Not everyone provokes you to think, but, seek that out in your mentors or seek that out in, your couple of close relationships. That's all I would say. Get to that level of conversation because that's what actually provokes you to reflect.
I had a similar experience when I was at Egon Zehnder. This must have been about 3 years into the firm. I'd made principal and was on the path to partnership. During one of the reviews, my office leader at that time, Govind Iyer, who's now a mentor and a friend, asked me to talk about my high points that year during one of the informal conversations over dinner. An ambitious search consultant enjoying his or her profession would have possibly spoken about a CEO he or she had placed or a high-profile mandate that he or she had won. I ended up referring to a couple of instances where I counseled candidates on their journeys and they'd expressed great gratitude for my time and insights. Govind looked me piercingly in the eye and said, "That's fantastic, Deepak, but that's not how we make money in the firm." That statement hit me like a bazooka. Now, a few days later, I was having dinner with a friend of mine, and I happened to narrate this episode. He looked at me and said, "I can see that." I asked him, "What do you mean?" He said, "You seem to have more of a coaching mindset than a poaching mindset." This was a moment when the penny dropped for me. I possibly had the skills of an okay search consultant, but I probably didn't have the wiring. And I feel it's hard to play the long game with a dissonance in the wiring. Once again, like in the case of Anu, this was an epiphany from unexpected quarters. I guess tuning into some of these inputs as we go through our journey can provide us conviction in walking a certain path, and sometimes even open a completely different pathway. I want to make one final point in the context of outside-in feedback. The answer is closer home than we all think. And it's none other than a spouse. They see who we are behind the curtains and they know what our values are and what our vision is. sometimes they offer a perspective that can be extremely valuable. R. Gopalakrishnan, a board member and an author of many books, calls this the Clementine Mirror, named after Clementine Churchill, Winston Churchill's wife.
Well, you know, I was very struck when I go to London. When I used to go to London, I would often visit museums. So I went to the Imperial War Museum in the local group near St. James Park, Regent's Park. And I found a letter there, framed and put up on the wall. And when I peered at it closely, it was handwritten by his wife, Winston Churchill's wife, Clementine, to him. And it read something like, "My dear darling Winnie, you're a wonderful man. The nation needs you now." It's dated 1941 or 42. But the other day I heard people say that you're now becoming irascible and impossible, and they're not able to talk to you. My darling Winnie, you know I love you so much. I wouldn't want anything better for you or for this nation to have success in the war. Why don't you bend your ways a bit? And it had all, it was a bit torn up and then put together again. And the story behind it, I learned later, was that she wrote this letter. He came so tired that evening that she said, "Oh, I can't hurt him further." She tore it up. Next morning, she said, "If I don't tell him, who the hell is going to tell him?" And she put the letter together. And that's what's framed and kept there. And then, of course, I've got the actual words and also which I mentioned and introduced the book. Now, this is what happens. I don't know how many times my wife has told me what a prig I was in a particular interaction. She says, "I don't understand what subject you were discussing. I'm not interested in, because that's not my field. But the way you spoke to this guy was wrong." And when I reflect on it, very often, even in a marriage, the spouse tells the other person, I keep saying wife, but it's the other way around, so I'd rather use the word spouse. "It's not what you told me that I object to, but how you told me." Show me a married person who hasn't been through that discussion. So how you do things matters a lot. And this is where the Clementine Mirror came in. It is not that Winston Churchill was wrong. It is not that he took the wrong decision. It is not that... but the way he came to his right decision was wrong.
Fair.
Now, Clementine Mirror is a... what an optical mirror does to your face. It shows you your how many pimples you got on your face, especially if it's concave. A Clementine mirror is nothing but a concave psychological mirror. Why is a mirror? Doesn't matter. A spouse is one such source. It's not the only source. So I've used Clementine because she happens to be the wife of Winston Churchill. It could be your wife. It could be a very trusted colleague. It could be a person whom you superseded, but who's an old friend for 30 years. It could be a board member. It could be anybody else. You have to be receptive.
A related point I might make in this context is that the nature of relationship between couples has also evolved over the years. A few decades back, it was about security, safety, and possibly a very clear distinction between who was a hunter and who was a gatherer. I guess things have become very different now. Jennifer Petriglieri of INSEAD, an author of Couples That Work, speaks about this phenomenon.
It's really interesting. So what we see if we track people's expectations from their relationships, from marriage, is they've really shifted in the last 40, 50 years. And they're shifting across the globe, even though the way we partner with people is different in different countries. So if we think back to certainly our grandparents' generation, marriage was about bringing two families together. It was about financial stability. It was about rearing the next generation. And it was about companionship. You know, we didn't expect a middle-aged couple to have huge passion in their relationship. You know, that would almost be a little bit odd. And we certainly didn't expect our partner to be... a partner for growth and development, right? It was someone who would hopefully provide a stable base with us, who would, you know, provide that comfort and companionship. That idea of marriage is really shifting. And what we see now is, first of all, people expect that passion to continue through the relationship, but they're also expecting their partners to be almost a sparring partner in their growth and development, to spur each other on, to bring out the best in each other. And it's really interesting if you look at the speeches of people when they thank their spouses. You know, in the past, it would be, you know, thank you for all your love and support and care. Oftentimes now people will say, you know, thank you for making me my best self.
Hmm.
And it's a real interesting shift.
It's fascinating to hear how Jennifer frames this. Helping your spouse play to his or her respective potential has possibly become a responsibility and a default expectation in these times. It would be a crime if we don't tune into the feedback we receive from home and what we are doing, and more importantly, who we are being. The other piece I've been reflecting on is whether you need a third party, a coach or a sounding board or someone else, to collect the data, or could you do it yourself if you're thoughtful and disciplined about it? A bit like how Rupa Kudwa speaks about connecting with 45 plus people when she transitioned from Crisil to Omidyar Network. In my personal experience, I feel there are two reasons why it's challenging to have good quality outside-in feedback. The first reason, it might help to have somebody collect the data instead of doing it yourself, is the calculus of silence point that Amy Edmondson mentions. As you become more and more powerful, just given the asymmetry of power and given what's at stake, a lot of people go quiet. It's often hard to figure out what they really, really think about you. It's helpful to have somebody to create that safety and collect the data with a promise of confidentiality and lack of attributability. People often say that there are online surveys that capture this. Somehow I find, while online might be efficient to administer, live conversations often reveal certain nuances which provide great insights in the leader becoming more effective. The example I use to drive this point home is that Sherlock Holmes never solved a case by administering a survey. The second and arguably more important reason to have somebody collect the data is that people who are close to you often hesitate to tell you in your face what your superpowers are, but would be very comfortable talking about this to somebody else. Dan Cable of London Business School calls this the eulogy delay. I feel not knowing your superpowers is actually a bigger issue than not knowing your weaknesses. Imagine this thought experiment. Imagine something happened to you and you're no more. Now imagine a loved one close to you. It could be your spouse, your child, your parent, or somebody else. Just one person. What would they tell their best friend about you when you're not around? Just pause and remember some of the themes that would emerge. Now bring your attention back to the present. What are the odds that this person would tell you all these things in your face with that much granularity and detail? Dan says that for some reason, people are very comfortable singing people's eulogies when they are not around, but hesitate to tell them directly. However, I've seen that people are equally comfortable talking about it to somebody else. When I speak to them about my clients, they're effusive and very candid about their superpowers. That's another reason why you should consider have someone collect the data for you, rather than you embarking on the data quest. Just a couple of things for you to bear in mind as you embark on this journey of deeper external self-awareness. Let's now recap this piece on external self-awareness. The first point here is to recognize that 360 is often not a 360. Well, it's not even a 180 sometimes. Just realizing this and ensuring that you seek input from a range of people that you've engaged with at various points can be valuable. It's also important to ensure that there's safety and trust in the relationship for us to get meaningful insights from the conversation. The outside world can also help us tune into our superpower or distinctive strengths. One of my clients called this the Hanuman problem. Even Hanuman did not know how strong he was. He needed Ram to point it out. We need help too. We then spoke about systematically gathering outside-in feedback, especially when we are in phases of transition. Then we discussed how feedback could come from anywhere if we are just open to it. We finally spoke about the role of spouses and our near and dear at home can play in widening our self-awareness if only we are willing to listen. Last but not the least, consider getting somebody you respect and trust to collect this information, to avoid eulogy delay and running the risk of misreading silence. I hope you found this compilation of value. Needless to say, self-awareness is a journey and not a destination. I can say with absolute conviction that walking this path of self-awareness has made a profound difference to me in terms of providing greater career clarity, improved relationships with people around me, and happiness in life in general. Trust me, it's worth it. Hope this episode gave you some pointers to further walk this journey. I wish you the very best. If you think this is relevant, do consider sharing this episode with your batchmates, friends, colleagues, or anyone else who thinks they are really self-aware. As we discussed in the first episode, they are the ones that probably need this the most. As you would appreciate, this series of Connecting the Dots is a new endeavor. Please do let me know if you have any feedback on the format. Anything you want me to do more of, less of, or differently. That would be really valuable for me and my team. Thank you for your listening and your attention. Do also consider rating and reviewing us on Apple or Spotify or wherever else you consume this content. It would really mean a lot for us to keep raising the bar on what we do. We also have a WhatsApp group where we share one or two pieces of content for a week. While we run the Connecting the Dots series, we'll be sharing nuggets along related themes. Over the next few days, we will share some nuggets on external self-awareness to build on what we just discussed here in this podcast episode. If you wish to receive this communication, you could store the number +91 85914 52129 in your contacts and just send a message interested in WhatsApp. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. First add the number to your contacts and then just send a WhatsApp message saying interested, and we'll send you the communication. In the next episode of Connecting the Dots, we'll take a closer look at listening. I look forward to having you tune into that conversation. Till then, bye now.